So before I start, I should mention that this is work done jointly with Ilka Bruner from Rutgers, and there's a preprint out on the archives and another paper, I suppose, to appear sometime or other. And what I want to start with is by sort of describing what the meta subject for this talk is. Namely, the question that I guess we'd all like to know the answer to is, what is stringy geometry? So, in essence, what we want to understand is what replaces our sort of classical notions of geometry when we do string theory. And some pieces of the answer to that question have been known for a very long time, by very long meaning on the order of a decade or so, and some things are more recent. So, for instance, things like Riemannian geometry and, say, solutions to the Einstein equations should be replaced by some two-dimensional conformal field theory with some set of properties that I'm sure you're all familiar with. And things like, say, cohomology, at least in particular instances of this, are replaced by the chiral ring, or some, the mathematicians often like to call this the quantum cohomology. The word quantum means we don't understand it. But really, I mean, this is something that appears at the classical level in string theory, okay? So quantum is a bit of a misnomer there. So these are some things that, as I said, have been known for a long time. But D-Brains, in particular, introduced some new challenges, things that one needs to understand. So, for instance, a D-Brain, in geometrically speaking, is some submanifold on which strings can end. And this should be replaced by some appropriate conformally invariant boundary conditions on the string world sheet. And that's a rather unruly set of objects. So one might try for a sort of cruder classification, like D-Brain charge, okay, which is some set of equivalence classes of the above. And we've learned in, actually originally from work by Greg and Ruben Menasian, and later by Witten and then a host of others, that this is related to K-theory in the classical geometrical context. And over here, I don't really know, but I can give it a name. Let's call it quantum K-theory.
So you're extending this
one. I'm using the same definition of quantum as above. Okay, so I'm not going to provide you with a definition of quantum K-theory today, but I will present you with some preliminary investigations about that subject, and hopefully... Right. Well, yes, right. So, in particular, one of the things I'm going to try to describe is how these quantum K groups move as we vary the moduli of some string background. So, in particular, I'm going to be interested in a situation where I both have a solution to the string equations of motion, and some interesting quantum K-theory, where I'll explain what interesting means in a second. And so what I'm going to talk about, the simplest context in which I fulfill both of those two criteria, are type 2 strings on R4 cross X, where X is some Calabi-Yau threefold. Okay, and that's going to be the subject of our talk. And now I'm explaining what I meant by interesting. You see, if I take the K-theory and mod out by the torsion in the K-theory, then that's essentially the same thing as the cohomology modulo of the torsion, and that we understand already. Okay, so to really get at anything new and interesting, you really want to study the full K-theory, including the torsion. In particular, you'd like a manifold where the K-theory has torsion. Okay, and so that's really why we end up in this context. So this is basically the same as so we really need to understand the torsion. And that's basically going to be the subject of our talk. So first of all, I'm going to start off with some sort of mathematical preliminaries just to kind of get everybody up to speed. And then I'm going to describe our sort of philosophy in trying to tackle this subject about which we don't know very much. And then I'm going to close with a few examples, depending on how much time we have at the end of this story. So first of all, let me start our preliminaries by describing exactly which K groups we'll be interested in. And my apologies to the experts who know this already. Let me focus on D-branes, which are particles in R4, okay? So these are D-branes, crudely speaking, D-branes wrapped around some cycles, so that the particles in R4. And so the charges that we'll be interested in will be in some sort of compactly supported K-theory of R4 cross X, where actually, what I mean is compactly supported in space, but not time. So it's really the compactly supported K-theory of space, which is R3 cross X. And now a little computation tells you that this thing there's a shift in the dimension. K0 over here is isomorphic to K1 of X, and K1 is isomorphic to K0 of X. If I'm interested in particles in R4, these will be the guys which are relevant in type 2B, and these are the guys which will be relevant in type 2A. Now, I haven't defined most of these symbols, but at least this dimension shift is actually familiar from good old electromagnetism, where it's known as Gauss's law. Okay, so let me remind you about Gauss's law.
Before Gauss's law.
What's before Gauss's law?
What does the hat stand for?
Okay, the hat meant compactly supported in space, but not time. Okay, and space but not time, and this means compactly supported in space. Okay. Not time, because they're particles, and so the world lines, you know, extend in the time direction. Okay, so in E and M, you know, there's the charge density J, which can be thought of as an element of the third cohomology of space cross time, which is, again, compactly supported in space but not in time, which when you go through a computation similar to the one that I didn't do over here, you find is H2 of the boundary, so this is 3 space, the boundary of 3 space modulo H2 of 3 space itself. Okay, and this is called Gauss's law because we measure the charge by integrating a 2-form, that's this class, over the boundary. And this is a 2-form which is in the cohomology of the boundary, but which is cohomologically trivial on the total space. Okay, and you know the 2-form is called star F, and of course,
So the condition that you mod by H2 of L3 there is?
That's basically, I need to solve the following equation, which is, what's it?
Here. Extend to the rest of L3, right. Not due to charges. It doesn't have to blow up the charge.
Right.
Okay. So that's why he's modding out there.
Well, what I was going to say was the following thing. I mean, the equation that you have to solve is D star F equals J, you see. So things which are really trivial, never mind what I was going to say. Greg's explanation is as good as mine was going to be, and mine was going to be muddled. That's right. Okay, so anyways, there's this dimension shift, and the only point of this was to explain the dimension shift. And now what I need to tell you is how to compute, a little bit about how to compute these K groups for Calabi-Yau manifolds of interest. And now the most familiar Calabi-Yau manifolds are obtained as hypersurfaces or complete intersections in toric varieties. And all of these have the property that the homology, and hence ultimately the K-theory, is torsion-free. Okay? And so since we're interested in things with torsion, those aren't useful examples. In order to obtain a useful example, what we can do is take one of those guys and mod out by a freely acting discrete group. So, why is a hypersurface or complete intersection in a toric and the homology of Y, and hence is torsion free. So we'll take X to be Y mod G, where G acts freely. And for the present topological purposes, that's actually good enough. If I want X to be Calabi-Yau, then G has to satisfy some further conditions. It should act holomorphically, and it should preserve the holomorphic 3-form. But actually, for the topological considerations that I'm about to talk about, those things don't matter. Okay, it's just some freely acting discrete group. what I want to tell you now in a few minutes is how, from knowledge of what I've written down over here, you can compute the K-theory of X and find that it has torsion, and then go on to study all kinds of interesting questions. Okay? So, the first obvious thing is that G, since it acts on Y, acts on the homology of Y. And so let me define the following quantity. It's called the co-invariant quotient. Those of you who are really bored by this can go to sleep. I promise to wake you up in 5 minutes when we're done. Okay. This is only if you really want to do some of these computations that you need to know how it's done. The co-invariant quotient HN of Y sub G, the little sub G is the my symbol for co-invariant quotient, is the homology of Y modulo A, where A is the subgroup generated by elements of the form X minus GX for X in HN of Y and G in G. Okay, so just quotient out by all of those guys and you get what's called the co-invariant quotient. And so I should say
that's not the same as just taking the invariant?
No. Okay. This is a little bit, a standard little bit of yoga. In cohomology, you take the invariant subspace. Uh-huh. In homology, you take the co-invariant quotient. It's just, you know.
Okay, but if I set x minus gx to 0, that's not the same as attention to x's, which are
g invariant? No, they're not quite the same. I mean, they these are dual notions to each other.
So if they're no torsions, would be the same.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, so let me tell you, my assumption is that Y is simply connected, and H2YG is torsion free. Okay, those will be the assumptions under which I'll be operating. Okay, and then the result for the homology of X is that H1 of X is the same as the first group homology of G, which is G modulo its commutator subgroup. Okay, so that's just G if G is abelian, and it's the abelianization of G if G is not abelian. And then H2 of X, which is the other thing we're interested in, fits in an exact sequence that looks like this. You take the co-invariant H2 of G, push forward there, and then H2 of Y, and then you have H2 of G to 0. So there's a short exact sequence like that, and H2 of X is obtained by solving that extension problem. Okay?
Is that unique? How do you,
there's a computation to be done. You need more. In general, you will need more information. That's right. And in some examples, we will use facts stolen from other people to obtain the requisite information. Okay. But yes, there's something that needs to be done. I've told you rather explicitly what this map is. Okay. It's the push forward. So, you know. Yes, it's unique, but there's work to be done to find it. Okay. And so anyway, so these determine, I've written down the homology, but once you know the homology, you know the cohomology. H2 of X, or at least its torsion subgroup, is, again, the abelianization of G. And that's also true of H5 of X. And H3 of X, the torsion subgroups so you have to solve that extension problem in order to determine them. And so these are the, so now you know the cohomology of X, okay, and then you stick this into a machine.
Don't you have to know H lower 3 of X?
No, you just need to know H lower 2, and then everything else is given by For Poncre Duality. Right. So now you stick things into a machine. The machine's name is the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence, but you don't really want to know what it's called, and you certainly don't want to know how it works. But the upshot is, but the upshot is actually that nothing really interesting happens there, and. Well, no, it's not always true. I should explain that the number we're familiar with the strange belief that the number 3 is large. Well, at least in this context, the number 6, namely the dimension of the Calabi-Yau manifold, is small. Okay, and for small dimensions, nothing interesting happens in the Atiyah-Herzebruch spectral sequence. And so, what I'm about to tell you is true. Okay. Eight starts to be middling big, and more than 10, which is to say more than we care about, you know, starts to get really big. Okay. But I think 8 is the minimum dimension for anything really interesting to happen here. So we're safe. So what we find in the end of the day, and there are a whole bunch of steps that I skip here, is that the torsion in K-naught is given as an extension of the torsions in the even-dimensional cohomologies. And the torsion in K-1 is given as an extension of the odd-dimensional cohomologies. And again, you may have some work to do to actually solve these extension problems.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know of any general way of doing it.
No, there's, well, I know of cases where...
The K groups are ambiguous. I mean, you've learned a lot about them.
You've learned a lot about them. I mean, you need to do some more work. Let me actually explain a little bit about one of these guys, and I mean there are explicit maps here, and you can
even with explicit maps.
But, well, I know, and in general, one has some pain ahead of one. But let me first of all explain a little bit about H2 over here, okay, and where that fits in, and this will hopefully be slightly illuminating. So the point is, let's say I have some class chi in H2. Some torsion class in H2. Okay, I can always lift this to a torsion element in the K theory as follows. Okay, I can always find a flat line bundle L such that C1 of L is equal to chi. Okay, and then alpha. Which is L minus the trivial line bundle, is an element of the torsion subgroup of the K theory of X. Now, chi might have had the property that n times it is 0. Okay, it is not necessarily true that alpha has that property. Okay, it's torsion, but it's not necessarily torsion of the same order. What you'll find is that n times it has vanishing first churn class. Okay, but it might have non-vanishing second churn class, which is to say it comes from here. Okay, so that's the kind of extension problem that's a guide to how you might go about solving the extension problem, which is to say you'll look at these guys. Okay, and then take multiples of them and see whether when the first churn class cancels, whether you get some non-trivial second churn class. In other words, something that comes from over here. Okay. Tricks like that, you know, can get you a long way. Maybe not all the way, but a long way. Okay, well, so that was most of the mathematics for now. And so, in any case, I mean, these quantum K groups, this was just the K theory, the classical geometry. This is the boring stuff that, you know, we learned about in childhood. And now we're going to try to, you know, move into the interior of the moduli space and think about quantum K-theory. So these quantum K-groups, whatever they are the discrete abelian groups. And so as you vary the moduli, obviously, since they're discrete, nothing can happen to them. Well, that's not quite right, because when you circle some singular locus in the moduli space, you can come back to yourself, but perhaps only up to an automorphism of the group. Okay? So the simplest thing we could do, a nice thing to do would be to characterize what those automorphisms are. And that's essentially going to be the subject of this talk. So, having gotten to the subject, let me try to at least suggest some things. This is now first we did the mathematics, now we're going to do the philosophy. Okay, I'm going to suggest some things which might help us to characterize what these automorphisms are. Okay, any questions so far? People are sitting in stupefied silence. Okay.
What's precisely, so you use the word quantum K-theory?
I just mean what D-brain charge is at a given conformal field theory in this moduli space. Okay? There's a set of D-brains. There are charges, in other words, modulo, some equivalent relation, are
clocked. What's the definition that you really should look at the K-theory of the moduli?
Well, I know what the abelian group is. I just don't know how to define it abstractly for a given conformal field theory. Okay? At large radius, it's given by the topological K-theory that I just described over here. Okay? At some other points, I may find some other way to define it by hook or by crook. Okay, but at a general point in the moduli space, I have an abstract conformal field theory. Abstract, I have D brains. I have their set of their group of charges, and I want to know what that group is in terms of the conformal field theory data. Okay, so I'm not going to tell you the answer to that, but I'm going to tell you if I take these groups and drag them around and come back to where I started, how they change, what automorphism they undergo.
So it's not, because you could also define quantum K-theory as the K-theory of the set of maps of a Riemann surface into a cloud.
Well, you could, but I don't know whether that has anything to do with what I'm after. If it does, that's a Giebenthal. And
that's also called quantum K-theory.
Yeah, well, okay. Maybe they're the same. Who knows? I doubt it, but right. So how might I try to characterize these automorphisms? Well, one thing they should do is leave invariant certain pairings on the K-theory that I will describe presently. The next thing that I will require is that they should commute with the quantum symmetry. And again, I'll explain what the heck I mean by that in a few minutes. And then finally, since we, as I said, when you mod out by the torsion, you understand everything, okay? In particular, you understand these monodromies, and so they should reduce to the known action. I should say why it's known. It's known by mirror symmetry on K of X modulo the torsion. Okay. These, I would claim, are obvious requirements, and it would be nice if it were true that these completely characterized what the automorphisms are. And I could lie to you and tell you that they do, but I think if you do sufficiently complicated examples, you find that they don't completely characterize them, so we need something else. And it's a bit of a mystery, you know, whether there are other stipulations that we could impose which would pin things down more reliably. But anyways, this will get us fairly far, so let's...
But in the two examples you studied with Oka, do you actually get the group?
In the first example, this suffices to completely characterize the things. In the second example, there's a finite ambiguity left over, okay, that we can't really fix, but it's most naturally, I mean, one answer, but there's no way to prove that. Okay, and in more complicated examples, I suspect it just gets worse and worse. Okay. So let me tell you what each of these things are so that you'll agree at least that they're reasonable things to impose. So, first of all, what are these pairings? Well, first of all, there's the skew symmetric pairing, sometimes called the intersection pairing. And I'll describe it on K0, which takes two elements of K0 and computes the index. I'm working with a Calabi-Yau manifold, so this will be the index of the Delbar operator coupled to V tensor, the complex conjugate of W. It really should be I really should write the Dirac operator, not the Delbar operator, but on a Calabi-Yau manifold, though it's agreed, and this is somehow simpler to deal with.
K-theory is found to be generated by the homomorphic.
Right. So anyways, this is on K0, and there's a formula on K1 if you really want it. And it's skew symmetric, and it's non-degenerate. When you mod out by the torsion. Well, so that's cool, but it tells us nothing about the torsion, right? So there's another thing that we can study, which is called the torsion pairing. Okay, so this took two elements of K0 and gave you an integer, or two elements of K1 and gave you an integer. Now what we're going to do is have something which takes a torsion element in K0 and a torsion element in K1 and gives you a U1 phase. Okay?
Wait, so in plain English, the first thing was you take the two brains and you count the number of Maxwell's fermions
What you do is you look at the open string sector with boundary conditions specified by the two brains. You look in the Ramon sector and you compute trace minus one to the F.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very nice. I'm happy with that because that's a definition that makes sense in an arbitrary conformal field theory. And therefore, since it makes sense everywhere along this path, and it's an integer, it obviously can't jump. Right? Good. Okay, now, so the intersection pairing, of course, now gives you something in U1. So the first thing you might say, well, obviously this is not discrete, it's continuous. Okay, so why can't it vary? Well, in fact, the only reason why it's written as U1 is to subsume all possible examples. In fact, in any given example, it gives you an element of Zn for some n. Okay? And that's discrete. Okay? Unfortunately, I don't quite have a definition of this in conformal field theory. Okay? And so I'd like to pull the same argument that I just pulled, namely it's well-defined everywhere along the path and it's discrete, therefore it doesn't jump. And I'd like to, therefore, come up with a definition in conformal field theory. I have some ideas, but they are as yet half-baked. So I'll just use this as a working assumption. Okay. Anyways, and I haven't told you what the torsion pairing is, and so as not to scare the little children in the audience, I won't, but I'll tell you how, what it is in one particular example, in one particular a simplified case, okay? Namely, let's say, sorry, this is a simple case, which will be good enough for the examples that I'm going to talk about, but will not suffice in general. So the simple case is let L be a curve representing a torsion one cycle in X, and then a D1 brain wrapped on L is the push forward in K-theory of the trivial line bundle on L, which is an element of its charge is that, which is an element of the torsion subgroup of K1. Okay. And now, if I take an element I just described over there, a torsion element in K0, namely a flat line bundle minus a trivial line bundle, and I now should tell you what the pairing between these two is. Well, it's the most obvious formula you could think of given these ingredients. The pairing between alpha and this thing is just the holonomy of L around L. Okay. And that's all I'm going to attempt to do today, because that's all we need at present. Okay, so that takes care of the pairings. Next, I'm going to move on to the quantum symmetry. So I'm looking at the...
Are you saying that there's a unique flat connection?
I'm saying that there's a unique flat connection.
Otherwise, there could be two different logics.
No. This is the pairing between C1 and I can think about it as a pairing in cohomology, in fact. Okay, between C1 is the element of H2 of X torsion subgroup, and this guy can be thought of as living in H5, the torsion. Okay, and so it's that pairing. It's a torsion pairing on cohomology. Okay. So
the way you said it, it's confusing because there might be more than one flat connection on alpha.
There are lots of connections, but the holonomy is this holonomy is the C1. Okay, this holonomy is the C1. Okay, there are lots of connections, but the holonomy is the C1, which is a topological invariant. Okay. So what about the quantum symmetry? Well, we have an overfold conformal field theory, right? We're looking at strings propagating on Y mod G. G happens to act freely, so the twisted sectors of the overfold have no massless states, only massive ones, but it's an overfold conformal field theory nonetheless. And therefore, it has an action of the quantum symmetry group, okay, which essentially weights twisted sectors by phases, roughly speaking. And that group is isomorphic to the abelianization of G. So if G were abelian, this would be just another copy of G again. And if not, it's the abelianization of G. And as I said, this acts on the twisted sectors of the closed-string conformal field theory in a familiar way. A little bit less familiar is how it acts on the D-brains, in particular on the D-brain charges. So let me tell you how that works. Well, the flat line bundles on X form an abelian group under tensor product. And that group is, again, G modulo its commutator subgroup. Okay? And so the way these things act on D-brain charges is just by tensoring with the associated line bundle. So GQ acts on K of X by tensoring with whatever flat line bundle we're talking about.
How do you find the inverse bundle and what is the dimension of it?
The inverse bundle.
If it's a group, you must be able to find
it. Oh, the inverse element.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's got, I don't know what to say, it's got the, its first churn class is minus the first churn. It's a complex conjugate. Yeah, it's like just the complex conjugate bundle.
Okay.
Okay, I mean, yeah. And since this is supposed to be a symmetry of the this is a symmetry of this whole family of conformal field theories, right? This whole family is a family of orbifold conformal field theories. And so whatever monodromy I have on these D-brain charges, it should commute with the action of this group. Okay? So that's another powerful restriction. And the last one, well, the last one is straightforward to understand what it means. Okay, so I've gotten through the philosophy, and now what I wanted to do was turn to some examples if there are no further questions. Okay, so let me talk about some examples. So what I'll do is I'll take everyone's favorite Calabi-Yau manifold, namely the quintic in P4, and discuss some orbifolds of that, okay, which will have hopefully mildly interesting K-theory. So Y will be the quintic in P4. And then what I'll do is I'll write down some free holomorphic group actions which preserve the holomorphic 3 form so that the quotient will be, again, Calabi-Yau. And it's rather famous that I can do the following things. X, what do I call them? Z1 through Z5 goes to Z1. I call it omega z2 comma omega squared z3 omega cubed z4 omega to the fourth z5, where omega is the fifth root of unity. Okay, this scaling symmetry acts freely on the quintic. Okay, and so the quotient by that is again a Calabi-Yau manifold, non-simply connected. Okay, so this is at 1z5. And then later, I'll consider a second z5, which acts by cyclic permutations of the z sub I. And on the in C5, that's doesn't quite commute with the first thing, but it does in up to a common rescaling of the z's. So it's a commuting Z5 in CP4. Okay? And it again acts freely on the quintic, and so I can mod out by Z5 cross Z5, and this will be an interesting manifold to look at.
You chose a particular complex structure on the quintic, I think.
Well, for instance, it could be just the Fermat one. Okay, so let me start off just by taking, by quotienting it out by the first guy. And study this story over there. So first of all, I should probably remind you about the K-theory of the quintic and what the moduli space looks like and so on before we start dealing with quotients thereof. So let me start with a little whirlwind review of the quintic. So I'll restrict myself just to K-naught, just to save time here. So first of all, the even-dimensional cohomology, which, as we saw, is what enters into determining the K-theory, is generated by 1, Xi2, Xi4, and Xi6 with relations that Xi2 squared is 5 Xi4, and Xi2, Xi4 is Xi6. Okay? Now, I can now, having told you what the cohomology is, I can tell you about the K-theory. Remember, there's no torsion, so actually these are the same, okay? But I'll present it as a little table. I'll give you the rank and then the Chern classes, C1, C2, and C3. So the first thing, of course, you can do, there's always the trivial mind bundle, okay? That has rank 1 and vanishing Chern classes. And then I can take, there's a basic line bundle whose first Chern class is Xi2. It's called the hyperplane line bundle because its divisor is a hyperplane in P4, okay? And if I take that minus the trivial line bundle, then I have something with first Chern class and nothing else. Okay? And so let me just, this is also, can be written as the charge of a D-brain wrapped along, of a four-brain wrapped around the hyperplane divisor. Okay? Which maybe might like that better. Okay? Or we can just call this by a letter and call it A. Okay? Then we can do something else. We can take a isolated holomorphic curve, a P1 inside of this thing, wrap a two-brain around that, and we can call that B. Okay? And this has second Chern class and third Chern class, but nothing else. And finally, I could consider just a D0 brain sitting at a point, and that has just third Chern class. Okay. I point out that these are both even, and in fact, that's true of any, well, I erased the index theorem over there, but for index reasons, the third Chern class is always even. Okay. And so these guys generate the K-theory, and it's, I mean, that's sort of nice. Okay. The intersection form that I wrote down before can be written down in this basis. It's some skew symmetric matrix. It looks like that. I mean, all of these are sort of trivial computations that you can do, okay, and so on and so forth. You can go to town and get the Kähler moduli space for this theory.
If you change basis to B minus C.
Yeah, well, then you change this thing.
And would it just be the intersection form of the cohomology?
This thing actually, the intersection form.
No.
But it doesn't. You can use whatever basis you want. I like this one because it's four brains, two brains, and zero brains. So six brains, four brains, two brains, and zero brains. Okay, which seems like a reasonable basis to choose. Okay. So this is the six brain. Okay. So what's the moduli space look like? Well, the moduli space is a three-punctured sphere. One special point is the large radius point. There's another special point, which is the mirror, actually, I guess, of the conifold. Okay. And there's one more point, which is the Gepner point. Okay. And now I will describe for the quintic, remember this is the old boring case that has no interest whatsoever, but I'll describe what happens to these K groups, to the K naught, as you go around some cycle circling one of these points. So we start some point near large radius and we've labeled the K group, the generators, this way. Now let me tell you what happens is we drag our theory around some loop in this space. When I come back, what happens? Well, if I drag myself around a loop around this large radius point, okay, what happens is very simple. Going around large radius is just shifting the B field by an integer class, okay, and that has the effect of taking any K theory element and tensoring it with this hyperplane line bundle. That's easy. That's trivial. Around the conifold point, what happens? Well, what I do is I take any K-theory class and shift it by a multiple of the sixth brain. Okay. What does that mean? Well, actually, the interpretation of this is fairly simple. It's the Witten effect. If I have a bunch, and let me actually write down a more general version of this thing. If I have a bunch of D brains, which, well, particles, charged particles in the four-dimensional theory, which become massless at this point, then the D brains which are magnetically charged with respect to the U1, with respect to which these guys were electrically charged, that was a mouthful, pick up a shift in their charges proportional to the, well, given by the following formula, V minus sum on I, V with WI, where this skew symmetric pairing is the thing that defines the Dirac quantization condition, right? And so mutual locality means WI with WJ equals zero for all I and J, okay? So here what happens is the sixth brain, wrapped around the Calabi-Yau manifold, becomes massless, and everything else, everything that's magnetically charged with respect to that U1, picks up a shift in its charge due to the Witten effect. Okay? And now...
in terms of what's going on with the D brains, the first monodromy is... Again?
Well, I told you, it's tensoring with this hyperplane line bundle.
So that means what?
Well, it's shifting the B field by two, okay? Okay. So this one is the Witten effect, okay? And now the product of these two, M sub G, is just M sub C times M sub R, okay? Because there's only two independent generators. And it has the interesting property that its fifth power is the identity. Okay, the Gepner point is a orbifold point in the moduli space. And the reason why it's an orbifold point, well, there are lots of ways of saying it, but I take a tensor product of minimal models, and I have to mod out by Z5 to enforce the U1, the integrality of the U1 charges. And so that orbifold of a tensor product of minimal models has an enhanced quantum symmetry, which is Z5. Okay, and so that point has a Z5 symmetry, so it's an orbifold point in the moduli space. And all we see here is this is acting on the D-brands, the effect of that quantum symmetry. Okay. Now, using the methods of Recknagel and Shomers, you can construct BPS, in this case B-type brains at the Geppner point. And let me sort of write down what these guys are. So these are, for the real cognoscenti, the L equals 0 B-type BPS brains. And these form the regular representation of this Z5. Okay, they're permuted by this Z5. So V5 is just this, our friend, the 6 brain. And V sub K is, well, it's just mg to the minus k acting on the 6 brain. Mg to the 5th is 1, so there are 5 such guys. Okay? Now, I told you these things in terms of K-theory classes, and so now this gives you a map between the brains you construct by purely conformal field theoretic means at the Geppner point, and these large radius brains, right? And that everything agrees. For instance, you can compute the intersection form of these guys, and it agrees with what you'd compute from this, okay? So it's all very pretty, okay? It's all very pretty, but it had nothing to do with the subject of my talk. Now let's go to the quotient by Z5, okay? Any questions before we do something new?
You mentioned that the things, these brains are the same when you computed them at this Geppner point and also at large radius. Is it obvious that they shouldn't actually sort of match up, or that there shouldn't be some BPS that you knew since you went?
Well, nothing was obvious, but I mean, this is actually a this was the discovery, if you want, of Gruner et al., right? That in fact these states do persist as you go all the way down.
Right? There's no marginal stability
for these guys, right? Yeah.
Couldn't they in principle disappear and reappear? I mean, there could never be marginal stability.
Oh well, yeah. I mean, you can imagine really sick things, but
if they disappear, what happens to the intersection?
Well,
isn't that all computable in the topological theory? That doesn't depend on.
I can imagine sick things where things disappear and then reappear again magically, looking exactly the same, you know.
Everything that decays is still present in the topological theory, and this pairing is so he would find that this works even if he's making a stronger statement about physical brains. But
well, no, actually, let me tell you, the interest. I'll tell you what. Let me not make a stronger statement than I need for my purposes, which is to say, what I'm going to try to do is construct brains at the Geppner point in some other model and identify not with BPS brains at large radius, but at least with K-theory classes. That, no questions of stability enter into. Okay, and that's what I'm really going to need. So let me not.
Just to clarify this point about Brunner, Douglas,
right.
Lawrence, and
Rollins. Right.
If I remember correctly, they're only getting a subset of the set of brains.
Well, one thing is that this set of brains spans an index 25 sublattice of the K theory.
Now, we don't actually know that things outside of that sublattice are populated by honest to God brains.
For instance, the D0 brain and D2 brain charge are all multiples of 5 in the lattice generated by these guys. So you'll never, for instance, get a single D0 brain.
So
you might get 5 of them.
Stability phenomena, which you would expect to apply to the other, the things that are not in that.
That's right. Okay. So, so let me now talk about X. Well, the moduli space, again, looks just like this one over here. It's the 3 punctured sphere. The intersection form changes a little bit. There's a new class, which, boy, I hate doing this, by erasure, alpha, which is a flat line bundle minus O, chi 0, 0. There's sort of one new generator, which is Z5 torsion, okay? And so it didn't appear in this intersection form, so I just omitted it, okay? And now if I write down the large radius monodromy, well, that still, I claim, to be understood by tensoring with the hyperplane line bundle. But the Karnefeld monodromy is that. Notice the presence of a 5. Well, what the heck is this? What the heck is 5? Well, 5, actually, you see, so even, in fact, even before we got to studying torsion, we actually knew about it, you see, because of this 5, okay? So what becomes massless at the Karnefeld point now? Well, there's our good old friend, the 6 brain, but there's also the 6 brain with torsion charge, okay? Also known as a flat line bundle. So there are 5 such guys, and all 5 become massless at the Karnefeld point, okay? And so what I really should do is use this formula over here, where what I really should have written is that this is V minus sum on K equals 1 to, equals 0 to 4, V with L to the K, but it's a fairly easy exercise to show that that can just be rewritten in that form, okay? And finally, M sub G is just M sub C, M sub R, and again satisfy M sub G to the 5th is 1. And note that it wouldn't have satisfied that were it not for this 5 over here. So the 5 is actually quite crucial, okay? So now, let's talk about the D-brains at the Gepner point. Okay, now the Gepner point has a Z5...
So these are now 5 by 5 matrices, or 4 by 4?
Well, these are acting on the K-theory, abstractly, yeah. Yeah, though, remember, one of them is defined, one row or column is defined mod 5, right, because this is 5 torsion. So, better to write it this way, okay? So the Gepner point, okay? The Gepner point now has a Z5 cross Z5 quantum symmetry. There's the Z5 quantum symmetry that we had everywhere, okay? And then plus there's the new Z5, which was the thing that enforced the GSO projection, okay? So the brains that I construct in analogy with this thing over here are permuted by the Z5 cross Z5. So there are 25 of them, okay? And I'll label them by 2 integers, N and M, each of which are defined mod 5, and they're, I'll write them this way, Vn5 minus M alpha where alpha is that generator over there, where V15 is O minus A plus A squared. Minus A cubed, V25 is minus 4O plus 3A minus 2A squared plus A cubed, V35 is 6O minus 3A plus A squared, V45 is minus 4O plus A, and V55 is just the sixth brain. So I should explain what these all these formulas are. So first of all, one of the generators is just M sub G, right? So I can take the orbit of this guy under M sub G. Okay, that generates these five guys. Okay? And then the other one is generated by taking the tensor product with the flat line bundle L. Okay, and what that does is, since actually the rank of this thing is 1 mod 5, okay, what that does is shift each of these guys by a multiple of alpha. Okay, so the 25 guys are obtained by acting with M sub G and tensoring with the flat line bundle. So I now claim these are the K-theory classes corresponding to the 25 brains that one constructs in conformal field theory. And indeed, if you compute their intersection forms, they agree. In conformal field theory, they agree with this identification. So I've identified what K-theory classes these 25 brains live in.
All right, so you do, again, the recognizable
Schumer. That's right. To construct these things. And now I claim these are the K-theory classes that they live in. Here's the proof. Okay, and now let me construct through the torsion brains. So the torsion brains are constructed by taking, all of these guys are BPS. Okay, let me take a stack of them in such a way as to cancel all of the BPS charges. Okay, so just take some V1N1 plus V2N2 plus dot 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 plus V5N5 such that the sum of the NIs equals 1 mod 5. Okay. But BPS charges all cancel, and I've interpreted it as torsion charge 1. Okay. That thing has a tachyon in its spectrum, but when the tachyon condenses, what one is left with is something with just torsion charge. So that's the torsion brain. Okay. So that's our construction here. Yes?
Are you working with the Z5 or before the Z5 cross Z5 now?
This Gettner theory is a Z5 cross Z5 orbital fold of a tensor product of minimal models. Okay? Just as the Gettner theory for the quintic was a Z5 orbital fold. Yes?
There's something that's not quite related to this that's confusing me. So,
okay.
So you have a one-dimensional camera modulized space here for this mm-hmm. fold. And you say at the conifold, or the mirror conifold now, you have five massless states.
At the mirror conifold, I have five massless states, right.
So is there a Higgs branch here now? Because in the original quintic, there wasn't, but you didn't have enough charged matter. But
that's an interesting question.
If there's a Higgs branch here, it goes to a manifold with no H1 loop.
Well, that would certainly kill, yes. Yeah, okay. Well, I know the possibility of a Higgs branch here is very interesting.
It would have frozen five.
Right, yeah. Okay. That's why we have these seminars. That's a very interesting point. Yes. Okay. Let me say, since I'm probably not going to get to it. How long should I just... What?
How much time do you need?
Well, the question is, should I talk about the other example, which has an assortment of rather interesting features that people might enjoy hearing about? It's 5-10 minutes tops. Okay. Shall I go on to the second example? Okay. So, So now we're going to mod out by both of these guys, okay? Now things change in a beautiful and interesting way. So how do things change? Well, first of all, why? Let's see. Why mod Z5 cross Z5? Well, the first thing you say is, well, that's my orbital fold conformal field theory. Z5 cross Z5 admits discrete torsion. Okay? So, gee, so I should not have to worry about, different branches of the moduli space if, depending on whether or not I turn on discrete torsion. Well, sort of, except that one sometimes also likes to think about discrete torsion as turning on a flat but non-trivial B field, namely that its field strength H should be an element of H3 of, in this case, W, which is torsion. Okay? Well, it turns out for this example over here, even though the group homology is non-trivial, so that I can turn on discrete torsion, this is trivial, and so I can't turn on a topologically non-trivial flat B field. So what the heck is going on? Okay. Well, turns out what's going on is, yes, indeed, you can have discrete torsion, but you can, there's no obstruction to continuously turning it off. Discrete torsion is a bad name because it's neither discrete nor is it torsion. But since I didn't coin the phrase and it's by now standard, there's nothing I can do about it. Okay, but the point is here, the conformal field theories with discrete torsion lie in the same connected component of the moduli space as the theory without discrete torsion. Okay? So the moduli space of, topology X, the quintic, or it's the quotient of the quintic by a single Z5 had a moduli space which was the three punctured sphere. This guy has a moduli space which is a five-fold cover of that moduli space. Okay? And it looks a lot more complicated. It has C1 through C5 and a Gapman point. Okay, so it has seven distinguished points on it. Okay. And basically what's going to happen is in this five-fold cover, you see here, at least in the mirror, you might say that the coordinate is something, some variable we might call psi to the fifth. Okay. And over here, the good coordinate is psi. And shifting psi by a fifth root of unity corresponds to turning on one unit of discrete torsion. Okay? Everybody is dumbfounded now. I'm telling you the sort of upshot of what happens in this case. So all of these models with different amounts of discrete torsion lie in the same moduli space, they just differ by shifting psi by a fifth root of unity, okay, which you can do. Okay, so in particular, there are five copies of this conifold point. Okay, and at each copy, something different happens. And to make you feel like you haven't wasted your time here, I will tell you what happens at each of these five points. Okay, so you'll then know something that you didn't know before. So before I tell you about the conifold points, let me tell you about the Gapner point. Okay? Yes?
If you're saying this
torsion can continuously change.
Yes.
How do you think about that in terms of the perturbation expansion?
Well, like I said, I mean, it's a flat but topologically trivial B field.
If I think of it as a phase that goes in front of each orbit of the Mossberg group of moments.
That's right. That's right. But now I can consider the theory everything you said before, but with a B field turned on. Shifting the B field by some amount gives me something isomorphic to the theory with a different choice of discrete torsion.
You're going to points that are not discrete torsion, but other kinds of points.
No. Those points are related. Everything is related by shifting the B field sort of 1/5 of the way around. Okay?
Yeah, I see. You're saying that those fifth roots of unity that you put into the pattern are going to be turned on by a globally defined B field.
That's right.
Yes,
exactly. Okay. It's actually not spheres, it's tori. And actually, that's an important point about the homology of this space, W, that will make some brief appearance in what I'm about to say. It's tori. Okay. Anyways, let me...
You're saying the second homology of...
I'll say what I'm saying in a second, but let me not jump too far ahead. Okay, so let me talk about the Gepner theory now. Okay, now I've written down these two transformations over here, and I said they commuted up to an overall rescaling of the Z's, right, which made them perfectly fine commuting transformations in P4. But now, acting on the tensor product of minimal models, a common rescaling of the Z's is a thing we call the GSO projection. Right? So actually, the Gepner theory is a quotient, is an orbifold of a tensor product of minimal models by a non-abelian group. Okay? It's a non-abelian group. Which I'll call gamma, with a whose commutator subgroup is this Z5, which implements the GSO projection. Okay, and whose abelianization is the Z5 cross Z5 that I've been talking about in the geometrical language. Okay. So it's a non-abelian orbifold of a tensor product of minimal models. Okay, that's not too scary. Okay, but let's think about the Dbrands from this Gepner point of view. The Dbrands, of course, involve representations of gamma, right? So we should work out the representation theory of gamma. Again, you know, it's a discrete group. If it were an abelian group, then that would be kind of trivial. Now it's all not completely trivial, but it's fairly easy. Gamma has 25 one-dimensional irreducible representations. Those are just when the GSO acts trivially, I get representations of Z5 cross Z5, and those are all one-dimensional, and there are 25 of them. And then there are four five-dimensional irreducible representations where the GSO acts non-trivially. So I can think of those as projective representations of Z5 cross Z5. Projective representations should make you think, oh, he's turned on discrete torsion. Keep that in mind. Okay? Good. So these, roughly speaking, are the things I would go into my constructing D-brains on in this at the Gepner point. Okay, and now let me talk about the quantum symmetry of the Gepner point. Okay, you recall the quantum symmetry group is the isomorphic to the abelianization of G, right? Or gamma, I guess I should call it. Okay. But that was, of course, just gamma when gamma was abelian, but now gamma is non-abelian. So the quantum symmetry group is the abelianization of gamma. which is just Z5 cross Z5. That's the same quantum symmetry group that we get everywhere in the moduli space. Okay? And so our conclusion is that the Gebner point has no enhanced symmetry. It's just a regular point in the moduli space. Okay, and in other words, the monodromy around it, in particular, should be just the identity. Okay? Good. So we've made a prediction. Okay? Now, let's go back to this complicated, nasty-looking picture over here and try to say what goes on there. Okay? Well, I can do the easy one first. Around large radius, I should shift everything by tensoring with a line bundle. I call this line bundle S as opposed to H because under the projection from X or Y to W, this thing pulls back to the fifth power of the hyperplane bundle. Okay, that's easy to understand. Remember, this is a five-fold covering, and going once around large radius here is like going around large radius five times over here. So naturally, that's why it's S. Okay. And then around the colifold, well, around the one with no discrete torsion, okay, what I should find is that the flat line bundles become massless, the six brains with varying amounts of torsion charge. Okay, and the flat line bundles on this on W are there indeed just 25 of them. Okay, so this is V goes to, by a formula similar to what I alluded to before, you get that. Okay, what about the other points? What about the other four points? Well, you might guess that what happens at the other four points is that the other things that could happen. Namely, that remember, those are points which differ from the conifold point by turning on discrete torsion. So you might say, well, maybe the rank 5 bundle associated to some amount of discrete torsion becomes massless. Okay, so V goes to V minus V with WK, WK. And indeed, we can work out the K-theory classes of these rank 5 guys. Okay, so WK is, well, first of all, it's rank 5. Okay, and then well, what should its first Chern class be? Well, I know that if I if I go all the way around, okay, I should shift this thing by tensoring with S. In other words, shift its first Chern class by 5 units because it's rank 5. Okay, so I might guess that if I go a fifth of the way around, I should shift its first Chern class by 1 unit. Okay, so let me write that in equations, k minus 5 times A, where A is S minus the trivial bundle. Okay, and then plus dot dot dot, I'll impose the recursion relation that WK plus 5 is WK tensor S. Okay, that actually determines these coefficients. And let's see if I can write them down, just for the heck of it. Actually, everything there vanishes. So this is 5 halves k minus 10 times, well, it's not very helpful if I don't tell you what the basis elements are, but whatever, k times k minus 10 times c. So I should write what these things are. B is the push forward of a two-brain wrapped around the generator of the homology of W, which is an elliptic curve. Okay. And C is just the the charge of a D0 brain at a point. Okay. And so what you see is that these things, for mentally speaking, I can think of this thing as W5, if you want, where W5 is 5-0, and then they all fit into this formula. Everything vanishes at k equals 5, and in fact obeys this recursion relation. Okay. So these are these, I claim, are the K-theory classes of the things that become massless at these 5 conifold points. And now, you have to multiply to obtain the monodromy about the Gebner point. Okay, and there should be a drum roll or something. Each of these matrices has, if you write them as, matrices, they have entries of order 10,000 and stuff like that. You multiply them all out, and of course, you get 1.
Matrices with 1 row being 0 and 5
row? Well, let me skip the torsion drives, just write them as 4 row. Okay. Now, this is the case where, so I've written down these formulas as automorphisms of the K-theory lattice, and I've actually made, the considerations that I discussed earlier in the talk don't quite pin this down. Okay, I actually do have a certain amount of freedom to tinker with these things by adding torsion classes in some way. Okay, that's... doesn't affect the fact that the product of all of these things is the identity map. Okay? And as far as I can tell, can't be distinguished in it because this thing is rank 5 and whatnot, can't be distinguished by any of the criteria that I outlined. So there's this sort of Z5 ambiguity, and I've just made the simplest choice in running on these formulas. But still, I think it's... kind of cool that we've been able to come this far. So let me just make some concluding remarks about where one might go from here, and then we can all breathe a sigh of relief at the fact that it's over. So I've really just been talking about the charges, okay? A more interesting and more subtle question is whether there are actually stable representatives of these K-theory classes at some given point in the moduli space. And that's a really hard problem even for BPS charges, and so it's impossibly difficult for these torsion charges that I've been talking about. Well, I can still say some things, okay? We constructed the torsion brains at the Gebner point, okay? So presumably there's some region in the moduli space over which these torsion brains are actually stable, okay? It's not clear that they're stable everywhere. Going back to this simple situation over here, it's perfectly possible that there's a curve of marginal stability surrounding the conifold. See, what's going on? At the conifold, the 6 brain and the 6 brain with torsion charge are becoming massless. Okay? So the torsion brain, for instance, could become unstable to decaying into a 6 brain anti-6 brain pair carrying net torsion charge. Okay. Whether that happens or not depends on how the mass of the torsion brain is behaving as you approach the conifold. If it also goes to zero, and goes to zero sufficiently fast, then it's stable. If it stays finite, then of course it must be unstable. Which happens, I don't know, but it's an interesting question to ask. Certainly there's, as I explained, since my simple-minded philosophical criteria don't quite pin these automorphisms down precisely, there's more to be done in terms of understanding what happens there. So Ilka and I are looking at some more complicated examples, hoping to find some insight. And with that, I think I'll close.
Okay, more questions?
Can't you actually tell whether the torsion grain also becomes lighter? Because there's some topological string amplitude that just counts the number of extra light particles in the singularity, since they couple with the long-range gravity fields.
They count the, you can count the number of charged particles that become light rather easily. That was what we did.
Just count massless particles, I think that's today.
Well, that's a possibility. That's certainly something to look at. That's certainly a possibility. I should say, Julia Bloom had an argument which indicated that, in fact, it is stable all the way down to the conifold point, but I couldn't quite understand her argument. It's unfair to say that she's proven it or not proven it, because I simply don't understand it. Yes?
You said that if the mass of the torsion grain doesn't go to zero, it decays to the V6 and
right.
anti-V6, but cannot you have a threshold bound state of the V6 and anti-V6 that carries the same?
Well, you can call that the torsion grain then, right? I mean, the statement is that the D6, anti-D6, are going to zero mass at the conifold point. Okay, so if the torsion grain doesn't go to zero mass, then it's unstable, right? Clearly, just on energetic ground. So if it goes to zero mass, then you can think of it, right at the, as you approach the conifold point, as being a bound state, which becomes actually a threshold bound state of the D6, anti-D6, precisely at the conifold, whatever that means. Right?
Thank you. Thank you again.